Job chapter 38, we're in our final message in the book of Job. And as we enter into the final sermon on Job, as I was reading Job 38 through 42, there were two movie scenes that came to mind. And the first one is this. This is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Kevin Costner is Robin Hood, very handsome Robin Hood, right? And he's about to marry the love of his life. And so he stands there, this is, I believe, at the end of the movie. And during the wedding service, the friar announces, "And I now pronounce you." And then all of a sudden, there's a voice from off screen that says, "Hold, I speak." And everyone is like, "Oh, what is it?" And they look around and they see that it's the long-awaited King Richard, played by Sean Connery. And King Richard is there in person. Everyone's amazed. And King Richard says, "I will not allow this woman to be married." And Kevin Costner's like, "Wait a second." And he says, "Unless I can give her away." And then everyone claps. Everyone's happy. And everyone lives happily ever after because the king has arrived. Second movie, and this, I do want to put a disclaimer here. I'm not endorsing this movie here. A Few Good Men. There's a scene near the end of the movie where the base commander, this is Colonel Nathan Jessup, played by Jack Nicholson, he's in court. And the JAG lawyer, Lieutenant Daniel Caffey, played by Tom Cruise, is questioning his actions there. And so Tom Cruise is like, "If Lieutenant Kendrick gave an order that Santiago wasn't to be touched, then why did he have to be transferred?" And right there, he knew that he had Nicholson trapped. And then he continues, Lieutenant Kendrick ordered the code red, didn't he? Because that's what you told him to do. And when that went bad, you cut those guys loose. Colonel Jessup, did you order the code red?" And so he's a little upset, and he says, "I'll answer the question. You want answers?" And then Tom Cruise says, "I'm entitled. You want answers?" And then that famous line where he says, "I want the truth." And Nicholson says, "You can't handle the truth." And then he goes on talking about how we live in a big, scary world, and it's his job to protect everyone there, and it continues on from there. Now, there's a big difference after that because Colonel Jessup gets arrested for committing a crime. So we're not going to make a similarity there. But that exchange between the lawyer and Jessup stuck with me as I started looking at Job chapter 38. For 39 chapters, other people are talking about God and his fairness. Friends after friends are saying, "God is fair." And then Job's speaking up and getting this bad advice from them. And Job's talking about how God is fair. And then other times he expresses confidence in his fairness. Other times he says God isn't fair. And by the end of chapter 38, we've heard a lot about God, but we haven't actually heard from God. And that all changes in chapter 38. God finally speaks up as if to give his case. God is finally arriving. And so it's as if the people are saying, "God, I want the answers. I want the answers." And God finally comes and says, "Hold, I speak." And then he says, "You want answers? I'll give you answers, but you can't handle the answers I'm about to give you, Job." And it would fit perfectly here if God had said in Job chapter 38 or 39, "Job, you can't handle the truth." Now I'm going to warn you that the last sermon here is not going to actually answer the question about why Job suffered. God's going to talk a lot here about different things, but he's not going to say why Job was going through what he went through. And by the end of the sermon, I'm going to challenge you to think about what God has to say here as you go through difficult times in life, but also as you go through good times in life. And so I want to challenge us about your perception of God, about what you see him as and how God is saying who he is. And so let's go ahead now and work our way a little bit through Job 38 through 42. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is it that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you will make it known to me." Now you can tell by the tone here that God's not messing around with Job, right? They've spoken ignorantly and arrogantly about God, and so now God speaks up and says, "You have advice for me? Let me ask you some questions." And then for the next four or so chapters, God is going to ask Job a bunch of questions. 77 to be precise. 77 questions for Job. Questions about cosmogony, astronomy, oceanography, meteorology, and zoology. So this, I read, is the longest oration from God in the Bible. And I like how one commentator put it. He says, "The divine professor sits Job down in his class and schools him with a lecture consisting mostly of questions that seem to have little to do with Job's suffering. Each question highlights the sovereign power, majesty, and wisdom of and awesomeness of Almighty God. Each designed to question Job's competence to pass judgment on God's providential operation of the universe. God essentially says to Job, 'Let me see your qualifications. I have a list of several questions here that I would like to ask to see if you are competent to understand how things are. And if you handle these basic elementary questions, then we will talk.'" So here's some of the questions. Again, there's 77 of them. I'm not going to read every one, but chapter 38, verse 4, God asked them, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it?" Verse 34, "Can you lift up your voice to the clouds, that a flood of waters may cover you?" Chapter 39, verse 1. "Do you know when the mountain goats gave birth? Do you observe the calving of the does?" Verse 26. "Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars and spreads his wings towards the south?" 40, verse 1. "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." Now, at that point, Job responds just for a sentence or two, and I'll get to that in a moment. But he doesn't even attempt to answer God's questions here because he knows that he can't answer them. But then God continues after that little pause and continues with a lot more questions. I'll give you one more in verse 8. He says, "Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right?" So in all these questions, what is God getting at? What is he trying to say, or what does he want Job to understand here? I want to put it in several different phrases here, or several different sentences. So to summarize, first of all, God is saying that God is far smarter than us. God is far smarter than us. Now, let me ask you, when your three-year-old lectures you on how to best parent, how do you respond to them? "Oh, you're right. I didn't think of that." Or maybe you'll smile and nod thinking they're cute and then go along your way ignoring what they have to say because they don't know what they're talking about, do they? Job and his friends had a lot to say about God. They had a lot to say about his fairness and, and what he should have done or did do and all of this. But in reality, they didn't know a thing. They were not in the position to question God. Second thing here, second sentence. God has a far better perspective than we do. I was thinking as we were, you know, in a football season here, when a drunk fan from the bleachers there yells at the coach that he should have done something, what does the coach do? He probably just ignores him. Because not only is the coach likely smarter than the fan, but the coach just has a better perspective of the players that he has and the health of the players and the plans and the offense and defense and all of this. And so the fans over here just see one little side of things. And so they're yelling out, oh, he should have done it this way. He should have done this. And yet the coach sees all the different pieces and knows just to ignore the guy over here. And that's how Job was and his friends were with God. They didn't see everything. And God's saying, hey, do you see what I see? I want to help you try to understand this a little bit more by just doing a little experiment. So who of you likes soda a lot? Are there any big soda lovers over here? Anyone? All right, would anyone like to come up and try to do a blind taste test of some sodas? You want to come up here? All right, come on up. Now, I do want to make a promise that there's nothing. Come on up here to the front. There is nothing disgusting in here. So all of these are actual cans of soda. In the past, I repent of grossing people out with things I've put in drinks for sermon illustrations. This is not one of those times, okay? So come on over here. So I have six types of soda. And so I'm going to just open these up here. There's number one. And I guess I should have had like an assistant or something do this for me. Oh, well. And can you tell we had a big budget for this from this box here for this blind taste test? Yep, no blindfold. No, I spent a lot of effort trying to make this here. Okay, so we have number one now that my hands are all dirty. So go ahead and taste number one and tell me what you think it is.
That is cream soda.
Cream soda. So you are wrong. It is Mug root beer, one of my favorite root beers, by the way. And by the way, youth, if you're here, you'll be getting a bunch of these on Tuesday. Okay, let's try the next one here. What do you think?
That's cream.
Cream soda again, okay? You are incorrect again. This is Crush, Orange Crush. So,
two down out of four.
Yeah, we have a couple more here. All right, let's try this one. This is
some of them, right?
It is not. Yeah, it's not carbonated.
Iced tea.
It is iced tea. Good job. All right, we'll give you that. I won't ask you to give the type. This is the Brisk iced tea. So there you go. You've just won a drink. Okay, this one is a little tricky. So I saw it there. It's a major brand, but they had some fancy flavor. So look, go ahead and try that one. What do you think? So it is a Pepsi, but it's Mango Pepsi. Did you know that even existed here? Youth, by the way, you'll be getting some of these on Tuesday as well. All right. Now, I'm guessing you're going to get this one. This one is fairly distinguishable, but I don't want to put any pressure on you now. Cream soda is incorrect. So those that know her here, please get her some cream soda for Christmas. All right, last one here. So this is not a soda, but it is in a can, and it is a drink. It's a popular drink, but go ahead and give this a try.
There's a name for it, though.
There is a name for it. And the name that my kids like is? Yeah, Yoo-hoo. Yoo-hoo there. All right, let's give her a hand. Do you want to take anyone back to your seat here? The tea here? Okay, I'm sorry I don't have a cream soda for you, though. Okay, why did we do this? Would you agree here that it would have been a lot easier for her to do this if she was on the other side of things? It would have been a lot easier for if she was over here looking at it and drinking it instead of over here. Now, likewise, who has the better perspective, the creator or the created? Who, in Job's story, had the better perspective of things, Job and his friends, or God? And what I'm trying to get at is that Job was down here. He was basically blindfolded, sipping the drink, having no idea what it was. God is on the other side, seeing all the things of what's going on. And then Job was questioning God for what he was doing, but God was the one that could see everything so much better. So we see things from our tiny little view, but none of us are in a position to question God. So God has a far better perspective than we do. Another sentence here, that God does not owe us anything. So when we think that God owes us something, like we've either earned something from him or we deserve something from him, then listen, we have elevated ourselves far higher than we should be. So God created us. We are the creation. He is the creator. We are the little clay, and he is the potter. What did God do? Or what did Adam and Eve do after he created them and gave them this amazing world and hung out with them? What did Adam and Eve do? They rebelled against him. We think of it as eating the apple, but that was open rebellion against God. So they rebelled against God when God had blessed them with so much. Listen, God doesn't owe us anything. He doesn't owe us anything. I'll talk more about that in a moment. Let's go on to the last sentence here, that God is not our genie. He is not our genie. Through God's questions here, God makes it very clear to Job who's in charge. God is not there to simply tend to Job's needs. And he is not here to simply tend to our needs as well. So God is, well, he's God. He's called in the Bible King of Kings. And that Hebrew, that's language for he is the supreme king. He is the Lord of lords. He is the supreme Lord. So we are the sheep. He is the shepherd. So God is not here just to serve us and give us. what we want. Now, after everything that God said to Job, I want to talk to you or show you what Job did in response. So in the middle of the conversation in chapter 40, this is what Job said. This is Job 40, verse 3. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice. I will proceed no further." Now contrast that with the chapters and chapters of words that he had to say before that. But when God spoke to him and put him in his place, Job basically said, "I'll shut up." And he sat down. Then finally, after God said a little bit more in chapter 42, then Job answered the Lord and said, "I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I do not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard you by the hearing of your ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." And that is the extent of what Job says. He doesn't go any further. So after chapters and chapters of Job talking, Job quiets down when God makes it clear how things are. And so I want to ask now, what can we learn from a chapter like this? Or from these chapters? What can we learn from basically a verbal reprimand from God to Job? And so I want to give you two things to think about. Here's the first one. So when we're going through suffering, and even when things are going well, we should approach God with humility and reverence. And if you're taking notes, I would even add, instead of approach, you could just write treat. Meaning, anytime you're dealing with God, directly or indirectly, we should do it with humility and reverence. Because God is love, as I talked about last week, but he is also God. And so we need to remember that he is not the one to be ordered around. So when it comes to God, we should go to him reverently. Reverence can be defined as a feeling or of showing deep respect to the person. It's recognizing that he's the one with the power and authority behind that love and kindness. So when you go to him, you should ask humbly. Humility can be defined as freedom from pride and arrogance. So putting these together, it's seeing him as the greater and seeing you as the lesser. And if you will treat yourselves accordingly, then when you approach him, you won't go with the wrong motives or attitude. Now I want to show just a short, maybe 45-second video. And then once we watch it, I'll come up and I'll explain what we just saw. So go ahead and roll that video. What you just saw was from SeaWorld back in 2010. Just minutes after that video was taken, that very whale there, that orca, pulled the trainer by the ponytail and arm into the water and kept her under there for 45 minutes, shaking her back and forth. And by the time they found her, they saw that not only had she drowned, but her spinal cord had been severed. Her jawbone and ribs and cervical vertebra had been fractured, and many other injuries beyond that. Why in the world did that happen, especially after what we just saw? How did something like that happen? There's been movies and books written about it, but it really comes down to this. That orca, do you know another name for an orca? It's a killer whale. And so while a killer whale may do silly tricks for food, what did the killer whale actually do eventually? He killed, because they're called killer whales. And that was the last time that a trainer or person ever went into the water at SeaWorld with an orca. Now, I'm attempting to give you just really a small taste of how we should approach God. Not from the sense that he's unpredictable or violent like an orca, but that there is power behind him, even that we don't see. The orca looked cute, didn't he? He did cute things, but there was power behind him. And the same is true with God. There is power behind his love that we must recognize. That he, as God, has power and authority. So we must approach him with reverence. We must approach him with humility that he deserves. One more thing that we should approach or treat him with: thankfulness and praise. Now, I've just established here that we should treat him with humility. And so if he's to be feared, then why should we be thanking him? But let me explain it this way by reviewing what we've talked about so far. God is smarter. God has a better perspective. He does not owe us anything. He is not our genie, and he should and certainly is to be feared. Yet in spite of everything like that, what has he done for us? As I previously mentioned in Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve sinned against God. They rebelled against God after God gave them all this stuff. And so after they rebelled against him, in Genesis, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, this is what he says to them. He says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman," speaking to the serpent, to the devil here, "and between your offspring and her offspring. He," speaking of Jesus here, "shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." So he's speaking of Jesus, that in the midst of a rebellion against God, in the midst of basically slapping him in the face and going and doing his own thing, God in his authority steps in, and he doesn't wipe them out. He instead sends his own son to die for them so that they may have a chance at life. That is a reason to be thankful, isn't it? All of us have rebelled against God. All of us have sin in our life. And yet God doesn't just wipe us out. Instead, he says, "Here, believe in my son, and I will adopt you into my family." This is not something that we deserve. This is not something that we have earned. This is just the grace and the mercy of God that he has given to us. There's a story goes, I think I shared this years ago, of this customer who was unhappy with a portrait that was taken of her. So she goes and she complains to the photographer, and she says to the photographer, "This picture right here doesn't do me justice." The photographer looks at her and responds by saying, "You don't need justice, you need mercy." We don't need God's justice. We need his mercy and grace upon our lives. We deserved to die. We deserve to die. And yet God has made a way for us to be saved. Now, at the end of the story of Job, God actually blesses Job. So even though he's just reprimanded him, God steps in and says, hey, I'm going to give you back what you've lost and more. Job chapter 42, and the Lord restored the fortunes of Job. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. But I was thinking about this, that the story of Job does not really contend or hinge upon him getting anything back. Because the story of Job is not about him losing and gaining back. The story of Job is about God being in control. And so whether or not he got anything back doesn't matter, except that we see here, Job didn't earn it back. God simply chose to bless him in that way. And that is a picture of us as well. Again, we didn't earn anything from God, yet God, in the midst of our sin, has blessed us doubly through his Son, Jesus Christ. So what should our response be even when we don't understand things, even when we're suffering, even when we're going through difficult times? The answer is praise and thanksgiving of God for what he has blessed us with. Now realize that Job is not a very good Thanksgiving, post-Thanksgiving weekend sermon, is it? But we've just seen what God has done here, and this, in a way, is all the more reason why we should be thankful. We're not smarter than God. We don't deserve anything from God. Yet despite all that, he loved us, and he made a way for us to be saved, to have a relationship with us. And so, listen, if you've never done that this morning, if you will put your faith in Jesus Christ, if you will turn to him as Lord, then whatever you've done in the past, it is forgiven by God. It is forgiven by God. And from that point forward, your past sins, your present sins, and even your future sins are forgiven through the blood of Jesus Christ. So I want to encourage you, if you've never done that today, on this Thanksgiving weekend, turn to him. Turn to him and ask him to be the Lord of your life. Ask him to lead you and guide you. You're not going to do it perfectly, but that's the first step that you need to take on the path to following and reverently honoring God. So we're in the midst of sort of this tension as I'm wrapping up now. We have the tension of being thankful and of praising God. And then we also have the tension of reverence and fear. And that's just the reality of where we live, the place that we live in, that there is praise needed and there is reverence needed. But it's in that midst, while we're suffering, that we can follow God and serve him. And it's not easy to do, but it's in the midst of these two things that we should go along and follow him and make him our Lord every day. I want to close with a story about a missionary from many, many years ago named Hudson Taylor. Hudson Taylor was a missionary in China, and he lost his wife and child in China. In 2 weeks after his wife gave birth, the baby died, and then Maria, the wife, had little strength remaining. And so there was another missionary in the room with them, and they recorded what the two of them said to each other. And so I want to read to you what he said. Hudson went to her and asked, "Darling, do you know that you're dying?" "Dying? Do you think so? What makes you think that?" she said. "I can see it, darling. Your strength is giving way." "Can it be? I feel no pain, only weariness." "You're going home with Jesus. Soon you'll be home with Jesus." There was a silence for a moment, and then Maria whispered, "I'm so sorry." And Hudson looked at her and gently said, "You're not sorry to go to be with Jesus." "Oh, no, it's not that," she said. "But it does grieve me to leave you alone at such a time. Yet he will be with you and meet all your needs." There was a missionary that stood by and later said, "I have never witnessed such a scene as dear Mrs. Taylor was breathing her last." Mr. Taylor knelt down and committed her to the Lord, thanking him for having given her to him and for the 12 and a half years of happiness they had together. And then a few days later, the biography writes from Mr. Taylor's journal. He writes, "I cannot describe to you my feelings. I do not understand them myself. I feel like a person stunned with a blow or recovering from a faint, and as yet but partially conscious. My father has ordered it, and therefore I know it must be best, and I thank him for so ordering it. I feel utterly crushed. Oftentimes my heart is nigh to breaking, but withal I had almost said I never knew what peace and happiness were before. So much have I enjoyed in the very sorrow." And that right there is an example of a man who understood the tension between reverence and praise, thanksgiving and humility, and knowing that he didn't deserve anything, but anything God gave him was good, and he was thankful for it. So as we go through this world, as through the rest of our lives here, we're not going to have a perfect time here on this earth. We're going to go through suffering. But God is going to see us through, and God will help us through every step of the way. And one day, there will be a day when all of that will be gone, and we can look forward to that time when it comes. So let's go ahead and spend a moment now in prayer. I'm going to ask the worship team to come on up.